This history video is being done for the Simulation History Project. Today is May 20th, 2013. We're located on the campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. The simulation pioneer we're interviewing today is Dr. Thomas J. Shriver of the University of Michigan. I, Robert G. Sargent of Syracuse University, is the person that's doing the interviewing. This history video interview is being produced by funding from the National Science Foundation, and the videos for the simulation archive located at the North Carolina State University Libraries. Since 1967, Tom Shriver has directly and indirectly educated tens of thousands of individuals in the general purpose simulation system, commonly known as GPSS, through his tutorials, short courses, regular academic courses, and the famous Red Book title, Simulation Using GPSS. Tom's contributions to the Windows Simulation Conference are well known and include giving at least one paper in every conference starting from the second conference in 1968, serving on the board of directors, being program chairman in 1976, and giving tutorials on GPSS and also how simulation software works. He has received several awards for his work, including the Informed Simulation Society's Lifetime Professional Achievement Award. Tom also was a pioneer in educating business school faculty at the national level about computers in the 1960s and 1970s. Tom, how did you come to be introduced to computers so early in their development?
Well, I finished my bachelor's degree in chemical engineering at the University of Notre Dame in 1957. I then went to the University of Michigan as a National Science Foundation Fellow to pursue graduate studies in chemical engineering. And in that first semester at Michigan, I took an elective course in basically algorithms and their implementation in those days in something called SAP, the Symbolic Assembly Program, and SOAP, the Symbolic Optimal Assembly Program, and found that whole experience to be very both exciting and intriguing. I might mention that the University of Michigan was at the cutting edge in terms of computing, one of several universities at the cutting edge, and so that was a relatively natural thing to do there.
Were you exposed to simulation during your PhD program?
A little bit. You could essentially know, but to some extent. First of all, during my graduate studies, I took a course in computer-implemented numerical methods using the Fortran programming language, and one of the systems that we programmed using numerical integration techniques involved, understandably enough in the context of chemical engineering, a tubular reactor where at specified temperature and pressure and chemical composition at one end of the reactor, materials were pushed into the reactor, moved down to the output point where the effluent characteristics had changed because of chemical reaction and heat generation and pressure changes. That was a very interesting experience. That was an example of what is called continuous simulation, where the state of a system changes continuously over time. The other flyby of sorts in terms of a simulation experience took place because at the University of Michigan, the National Science Foundation was funding summer programs to bring engineering faculty to Ann Arbor from around the country for the purpose of educating them in computing, in the applications of computing and engineering. And as a student assistant in that context, I was assigned to audit a lecture given by an industrial engineering professor at Michigan, Dick Wilson. Dick Wilson gave a lecture on discrete event simulation, and it was my responsibility to take notes on the lecture and then write up those notes for distribution to the faculty. Other than that, no, I never took a course in certainly discrete event simulation at Michigan. I'm not aware that there were even courses of that type offered at that time.
Probably not. While you're finishing up your PhD, you joined the faculty at Eastern Michigan University, and then you joined the faculty of the Graduate School of Business at the University of Michigan. How did these appointments come about?
Well, through a probabilistic chain of events, you could say. First of all, my first 3 years of graduate work were supported by the National Science Foundation as an NSF Fellow. In the fourth year, I was an International Nickel Fellow doing experimental research for the PhD in chemical engineering. I fully expected to finish the experimental research, evaluate and write up the results, and be done at the end of the fourth year. At the beginning of the fourth year, as a result, I applied for a Fulbright Fellowship to Germany. That application was successful. However, I fell short, as is sometimes the case, in terms of finishing the dissertation by the end of the fourth year. I decided, nevertheless, that I wanted to have the experience of being a Fulbrighter in Germany for a year. And so I went to Germany for the year, and then returned to Ann Arbor to finish the dissertation. Well, in the meantime, I had been on the dole, so to speak, as a graduate student for 5 years, and I really felt in good conscience I should start to earn my own keep in direct terms. I had a master's in mathematics that I had picked up along the way at Michigan, and so I wound up taking a half-time position as an instructor in the math department at Eastern Michigan. Partway through that experience, the provost called me in and said, we need to get going in academic computing here at Eastern Michigan, which, by the way, is only 10 miles or so east of Ann Arbor, and so it was conveniently located. I lived in Ann Arbor. Said the provost, be game to introduce courses on computing into the curriculum in the math department, and take responsibility for establishing a small academic computing center. It sounded intriguing to me, and so I said yes. I thought I had enough slack in my life to be able to do that, at least for a few years. And so then for the next 3 years, beyond that first year as a half-time instructor, I engaged in those activities at Eastern Michigan. Then the thought occurred to me, I really should return to my chemical engineering roots. It's about time. So I began to prepare my resume to send to chemical engineering departments. One day the phone rang. It was the caller was a fellow named Alan Spivey, who was a professor in Michigan's, at that time, Grad School of Business, it was named. He was chair of the Statistics and Management Science Department. He had talked to somebody at a cocktail party about how they had to get going in computing in the MBA curriculum at Michigan, and somebody said, well, there's this guy, Tom Schreiber, who might be able to help you in that regard. So I met with Alan Spivey, and he is a very persuasive personality. I came away deciding I would roll the dice and become a faculty member in the Grad School of Business at the University of Michigan. That's how that came about.
And you've been there 47 years to date.
And just completed my 47th year. My thinking at the time was, if it doesn't work out after a couple of years, I still haven't burned my bridges behind me in chemical engineering. But I never looked back. And as you say, 47 years later, amazing.
Okay. Early in your professional career, you started educating business school faculty on computers across the country. And so please tell us about this national activity that you did to educate business school faculty about computers.
Well, as already mentioned, as a graduate student in chemical engineering, I had experienced the National Science Foundation funded engineering faculty summer programs in computing at Michigan for the purpose of getting engineering faculty going in computing. Business school faculty at the national level had the same need to get going in computing in appropriate areas of specialization, finance, marketing, accounting, for example, management science, as engineering faculty had. So the thought occurred to me, why not take the engineering college NSF-funded model or program as a model and replicate that within reason with appropriate changes at the business school at the University of Michigan. So working cooperatively with Alan Spivey and with the dean of the business school, we succeeded in obtaining official endorsement for such an activity from the American Association of Collegiate Schools of Business, which is the accrediting organization. And we also obtained funding from International Business Machines to bring faculty in from around the country. And so with the first offering in the summer of 1969, whereas I had joined that faculty in the summer of 1966, we had the first offering of a two-week program in that regard. By the time the dust settled and the programs were over, there had been six offerings of those programs. There had been offerings in 1969, 1970, 71, and then 73 in Ann Arbor, and offerings in 71 and 73 at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
So by then, Tom Schreiber was well known in business schools across the country, yes. Mm-hmm. You wrote some books about computing in addition to your simulation books. How about tell us about the non-simulation books that you wrote for business school people?
Sure, gladly. First of all, I believed or experienced that a good way to convey algorithms to what I would call, quote, MBA-type students was diagrammatically, that is, with flowcharts. And so I was teaching computing, not simulation in particular, but more generally speaking, computing, using flowcharting techniques. And from that came a book published in 1970 by John Wiley called, entitled Fundamentals of Flowcharting. And then this was strictly flowcharting, language independent. As a basically companion to that, also in 1970, with Wiley, I published an item that you can see here called Fortran Case Studies in Business Applications, designed to take advantage of the flowcharting and so on. I also published with Wiley a set of paper masters for overhead transparencies that could be used for people teaching from the flowcharting book, you know, making transparencies using an overhead projector, which was in some sense state of the art at that time in that era. And then those materials in turn fed directly into the business faculty summer programs in computing.
Certainly did a lot to educate business faculty people about computing, so that's fantastic contribution to society here.
We estimated that in the six program offerings, at an average number of business faculty of 50 per offering, that we, so to speak, got to about 300 business school faculty people in the country. Now, IBM put up the funds needed to publish a three-volume set that resulted from the 1969, 70, and 71 program offerings in Ann Arbor. Those were co-edited by my PhD student, Larry Maddio, and me. They are titled Fortran Applications in Business Administration. IBM also put up the funds to print those volumes by the hundreds and send them to business school libraries all around the country.
Farther making Tom Schreiber better known, yes, as a promoter of computing. That's great. That's fantastic. So let us now turn our discussion to simulation, which is the history of simulation. Is a series they're working on, but I think it was important to get your background in these other areas. So how did you become involved with discrete event simulation, and how did you come to use it?
Well, the person who hired me in on the U of M Business School faculty, Alan Spivey, approached me halfway through my first year, the 66-67 academic year, and said, there's a methodology coming down the pike that I think has great potential. It's something called discrete event simulation. I think we should have a course on discrete event simulation in the MBA curriculum. Would you be the person to see to it that such a course takes place? Well, you're a young guy on a tenure track. You don't think you'd say no. And so I surveyed several of the languages that were prevalent at the time for discrete event simulation. These took the form of GASP, General Activity Simulation Program, with Fortran roots, SimScript, Simulation Script, and IBM's GPSS, General Purpose Simulation System. I wound up concluding, for several reasons, that GPSS would be the language that probably had the greatest potential for success in the MBA curriculum. First of all, the learning curve is not steep in terms of getting, you know, your first models out, and people begin to grow into a sense of comfort, into a comfort zone, number one. Number two, the syntax of the language is sparse, and that in turn was a plus among the type of student I was dealing with. And then thirdly, a diagrammatic approach could be taken, block diagramming, to basically represent the chronologically ordered sequence of flows in the system being modeled. That was also, I considered, to be a plus. There were, in my judgment, no good textbooks that could be used for such a course. So I studied GPSS in such a way that by the fall of 1967, start of my second year there, I could introduce two sections of a new course in discrete event simulation. Now, in those days, people, the instructors often walked into a classroom, picked up a piece of chalk, and began writing on the blackboard. Well, that takes time cuts into the rate at which you can cover material. So I began writing notes on sheets of acetate using an overhead projector to project the notes so that we could move through them rapidly. And to for the sanity of the students, I had the notes reproduced and distributed copies to the students. I then improved the notes in the winter of 68 for the two-section offering then, and that summer further improved them, farmed them out to a local printer who printed them in softbound form, and I put them on consignment with an Ann Arbor bookstore.
Those were the brown copies, I remember.
Those were like the brown copies. So oh, yeah. There was a period of successive refinement that took place. Meantime, publishers' representatives came across these notes in the bookstore that I was using, Ulrich's bookstore, and approached me in three cases with offers of contracts to map the notes into a full-fledged textbook. So there were offers from McGraw-Hill, from Prentice Hall, and from John Wiley and Sons. I wound up going with John Wiley and Sons. And then finally, in the summer of 1974, the publication named Simulation Using GPSS became available that August. August 24th, 1974, the same day that our son was born and that Nixon resigned. It was a Friday.
Trifecta.
It was the book was a hardbound, 8.5 by 11, 532-page book with a red cover.
Why don't you hold it up and show it to us, famous red book. This is called the famous red book.
So this is, quote, the red book, unquote. as a result of the red cover, the red book made a lot of sense.
And how many copies were totally made out of 40 printings? I understand 40 printings were made of that book?
Yes, there were at least 40. There might have been 41, 42 over a 21 year period of time. And so my approximately 40,000, something a little in excess of 40,000 copies of that book were produced. And then, in addition, it turns out that the book was translated into Russian. And the Russians did a standard production run, 10,000 copies. They never had a second printing, 10,000 copies produced. But they were faithful to the design, to the Wiley design, 8.5 by 11, hardbound, red cover, and that book became known as the Red Red Book.
Yeah, show us that, the Red Red Book.
So here is a copy of the Red Red Book.
I don't think I ever saw your name written in red red before.
It's nothing like the Cyrillic alphabet. So between the two versions, if you will, of the book, there were round numbers, 50,000 copies that were put into circulation over...
That's probably far, far more than copies of any other simulation book that was ever written.
I believe at that time that set a record, yes.
I'm sure still record today.
Maybe so. I'm not sure.
I personally haven't used your GPSS textbook. I know that you prepare and give additional materials to aid in teaching and learning. Please comment on this.
Well, there were two things. Wiley published a solutions manual for the exercises in the book. That was 1975. And then, in addition, I prepared an extensive set of transparency masters that could be used by instructors teaching from the book to speed up the process of delivering information in the classroom.
You brought those along, too, didn't you?
Well, I brought an example of those along. I think we'll talk later about short courses in GPSS.
Well, that's going to be my next question. What motivated you to give tutorials and short courses on GPSS so you can delay showing those if you wish?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it turns out that at the University of Michigan in the late 50s, early 60s time frame, something called the Engineering Summer Conferences were created. They were 1 and 2 week courses taught in the summer and designed to provide educational opportunities for practicing engineers and other professional people interested in such topics. And the thought occurred to me, hey, how about an intensive 1 week course on simulation using GPSS in the engineering summer conferences? Now, granted, I was a business school faculty person, but it doesn't mean there were walls built up between the School of Business and the engineering college.
Well, you had a PhD for the engineering school.
And, so. Right. And so I made the proposal to them, and the proposal was accepted. And then in 1970, for the first time, I taught, chaired and taught an intensive 5-day course on simulation using GPSS. That course then continued for a total of 24 offerings, finally with the last offering taking place in the summer of 1993. As a matter of fact, there were two additional offerings in the summers of 73 and 74. There were, in addition to the standard offerings, there were offerings targeting faculty people, specific to faculty people around the country. The tuition was set very low, or the course registration fee was set very low to encourage their participation and so on. And so here's an example you can see in terms of just the thickness of this three-ring binder. This is a three-ring binder from the 1991 offering of the course in engineering, University of Michigan engineering short courses, and I taught using transparencies in those days, and then the students had copies of the transparencies.
You can't quite see it. You got the wrong page. Yeah, there you go.
The students had copies of the transparencies, so they didn't really have to take notes, and to the extent that they might want to go back and teach GPSS themselves, they had the skids were greased for them in terms of lecture prep and teaching materials. That
was similar stuff you sent out to faculty members, because I know I had those make my transparencies that I used.
Right, exactly.
And do that. Well, you also did some additional short course teaching, I think, through Wolverine software.
That's true. It turns out that a fellow named Jim Henriksen, whose name is otherwise coming up in the context of the simulation archives, and was a student of mine in the credit course in simulation in the winter of 1968. Jim, as it turns out, was wearing two hats in the winter of 1968. On the one hand, he was a student in the course. He was in the MBA program. On the other hand, he was working part-time in Michigan's Academic Computing Center, and he happened to be in charge of simulation languages in the operating system of the day at Michigan. And as we came across alleged bugs in IBM's GPSS 360, Jim would be my contact person in computing center terms that I would approach, you know, look at this situation. I think it implies that there's a problem with the code. So Jim wound up having many occasions. We found on over 30 bugs in IBM's GPSS 360. over about a two-course offering span of time. Jim had many occasions to crack the code and look at GPS's 360 was written in assembly language, Jim became very interested in the implementation. He thought he saw clear-cut ways to improve the implementation, and he wound up eventually introducing his own implementation of GPSS, known as GPSS-H, and formed a company as the vendor and began sending his clients, or suggesting to his clients, that they come to the engineering summer conferences for education in simulation using GPSS-H. As that implies, in the meantime, I had dropped IBM's GPSS 360, which IBM, by the way, stopped supporting. Well, they went through IBM through GPSS 5, but they stopped supporting it in the summer, or in 1975. But we switched to GPSS H, which was a, you know, hands down, it was a clearly superior product. And then Jim discovered, as GPSS H grew in popularity, that a once-a-year offering of an intensive five-day course in GPSSH was not sufficient. And so he engaged me to supplement the summer offerings in Ann Arbor with additional offerings under the auspices of Wolverine Software Corporation, the company that he formed. And so in 1982, for the first time, I taught an intensive short course during the U of M winter break, the 1 week winter break. My wife was happy about that.
So how many students do you estimate you taught in these short courses?
In the short courses? Well, I estimate there were about maybe 40 offerings of short courses between the engineering summer conferences and the ones taught under the auspices of Wolverine Software. I estimate that the total number of students that took those courses came to about 1,500. We would have 45 to 50 students in the engineering summer conferences, a smaller number in the courses sponsored by Jim Henriksen, 15 to 20.
That's a large number of people exposed to GPSS, but you also taught these academic courses in business schools. So how many people do you think got exposed to GPSS through those courses?
Well, again, the first of those was offered in the fall of 1968. The last of those was offered, as it turns out, in the fall of 1995. I estimate that many times there were two sections offered per semester, two semesters a year. So I estimate that in total about 115 sections of that course were offered, averaging about 50 students per section. I think that number comes to about 5,750 students who took the credit course in discrete event simulation with emphasis on the use of GPSS.
And then you had all those people that read your GPSS book, so you exposed the world many times over to GPSS through your books and short courses.
Well,
so
my estimate on the books is that with about 50,000 copies published, and just estimating that each book was used by, on average, three students. The student who bought the book, the next student who made use of it as a used book, and then the successor to that student. So if I multiply the 50,000 by three, I get to about 150,000 people who might have been exposed to GPSS through a combination of the Red Book and the Red Book.
Very, very good. So tell us about your involvement with the Winter Simulation Conference. You have set a record in terms of length of time involvement with this conference.
Well, the first winter, the first conference in that series took place in the fall of 1967. It was called Conference on the Applications of GPSS. It was a conference that was fairly widely known on the East Coast, but not fairly widely known at the national level at that time. The conference was successful to the point that there was a successor conference 1 year later. The name was changed, Conference on the Applications of Simulation. That conference then continued basically uninterrupted year after year. In 1971, the name was changed to the Winter Simulation Conference. That conference still continues to this day. It is recognized as the outstanding conference internationally on discrete event simulation. So my first personal involvement took place in the fall of 1968 when I attended the conference and gave a paper on the use of GPSS and job shop scheduling, written with a co-authored with a student of mine, Bob Lefkowitz. From that point, things simply took off. Program chair of the 1976 offering, with you, Bob, as associate program chair of the conference, tutorials on GPSS given at the conference, eventually tutorials on inside simulation software, how it works, why it matters to know how it works. Board of directors for 10 years, chair of the board for 2 years.
You've given a paper every year since 1960, at least one paper every year since 1968, continuing to date.
That's correct.
And I believe you received a landmark paper at the 40th anniversary in 2007.
That is correct. Yes, that landmark. There were 10 papers identified at the 40th anniversary of the Winter Simulation Conferences, 10 papers identified as key papers that had been given during the 40-year history of the conference, and the inside simulation software paper was selected as one of those 10 papers.
In addition, I see that you were one of the people who spoke on the silver anniversary of that in 1992. So
yes, that's true. It was a privilege to be selected as a person who could comment on the.
And then you became a titan of simulation, giving a talk in 2009.
That is also true. That was a real kick, and I had a little bit of a more than a little bit. I was motivated to give that Titan talk on the topic of Monte Carlo simulation using spreadsheets. What I saw there was a possibility for a good synergistic effect, because the audience, those who come to the Winter Simulation Conference, are at least for the most part rather deeply into discrete event simulation, but probably hadn't thought in at least many cases about simulation, Monte Carlo simulation, on spreadsheets, in the context of spreadsheets. And yet the application potential on spreadsheets is enormous, somewhat different in type than, say, the design and manufacturing systems. And I thought that by poking people in the eye, some of them might be motivated to add to their bag of tricks and enhance their utility, their usefulness to their employers by spreading their wings beyond whatever degree they had been spread at that time.
And you were also a member of the founding board for the WSC Foundation, so.
Yeah, that's correct. Was a member of the WSC Foundation for 5 years and was chair of the board for 1 year.
And you were one of the participants in the founding of that, too.
And a participant in the founding, yes.
Yeah. So you give the introduction to GPSS tutorial from 1968 until when? Do you remember?
Yes. The last offering of that tutorial was at the 1995 winter simulation.
1978, then I guess, to 1995, you give that tutorial.
Yes, actually, the tutorial, the first record and proceedings of the tutorial is at the 1976 conference. Mm. I had given the tutorial at preceding conferences, but had supported it with handouts rather than with proceedings entries. Mm. From 1976 forward, it was always supported with proceedings entries. It came to an end after the 1995 offering, because in the meantime, it had become possible for vendors to give tutorials at the winter simulation conferences, and Wolverine Software began giving GPSSH tutorial with Jim Hendricks and Bob Crane and people like Dan Bruner, and so it was redundant really to continue.
So then you moved to your other tutorial you give, how discrete event simulation software works. So you start that in 1995 and you continue today.
That's correct. And that tutorial was put together with a former student, Dan Bruner, a graduate of Michigan's MBA program, who went into simulation upon graduation and has hung his hat on a career in simulation ever since.
And that's the paper that received the 40th anniversary.
That's correct. Yes.
And so you also were an ACM lecturer. So could you tell me, comment on that, please?
Yes, ACM, the Association of Computing Machinery, established a national lectureship series, making it possible for ACM chapters around the country to bring in ACM lecturers to give, you know, I'll say 50, 60-minute talks at ACM chapter meetings on specialized topics. So in 1969, I became an ACM lecturer, lecturing on the topic of discrete event simulation. I continued that process for 3 years. The last two of those 3 years, I co-chaired the ACM National Lectureship Series.
More exposure to people about simulation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
I know that you're also on the exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union in 1977. Could you tell us about this program where you represent the United States abroad, please?
Yes, in the 1970s, there was something called a Joint Science and Technology Agreement that was formed between the USSR and the United States. I was invited to be one of six people who participated in that agreement by going to the Soviet Union or the USSR in of all the times of the year, February of 1977, to give seminars across a widespread area. We gave seminars in Moscow, in Estonia, in Azerbaijan, in Uzbekistan. There was a very interesting design in terms of the composition of the six of us. Moving from the East Coast toward the West Coast, the universities represented were Harvard, MIT, the University of Michigan, Stanford, and UCLA, one person from each of those five universities. And then the sixth person was a, kind of a program director internal to Harvard who came along to help us cross the T's and dot the I's in the conference. Then, and by the way, I think it was probably the delivery of seminars on discrete event simulation using GPSS in the context of that program that led to the translation of the book, the Red Book, into the Red Red Book. So that was 1977. The Red Red Book was published in 1980, only 3 years later. What we did, those of us who went to the USSR for a couple of weeks like that, we, in our turn, later were sponsors of visiting, in our respective universities, of visiting delegation, the corresponding visiting delegation from the USSR. It was a very nice experience in many, many ways. It was hard to keep up with the toasting. Lots of times vodka had to be thrown into the flower pot. But nevertheless, it was a great experience.
I know that, you know, you went to Germany on a fellowship, but you also got interacting with somebody named Peter Lawrence that was in East Germany, and then to continue after the Iron Curtain come down. So could you tell us about your experiences with Peter Lawrence and GPSS stuff regarding that area?
Yes, I would be happy to do that. As you mentioned, Peter Lawrence, Peter Lawrence is now an emeritus professor at the Otto von Guericke University of Magdeburg in the state of Sachsen-Anhalt in Germany. Magdeburg is in former East Germany. Peter Lawrence invested himself heavily during the days of the USSR in the methodology of discrete event simulation, did a lot of writing in that area. There was a German implementation named SIMDIS of what was basically GPSS. And Peter, I think, came to know of me through the Red Red Book. And we had some correspondence. In those days, it took the form of postal mail that had to always go in both directions through Moscow and be vetted. They did not have email in those days yet, even after email was rather common, you know, outside of the USSR. So then, with the fall of the wall, as it's sometimes described, the fall of the Berlin, the knocking down of the Berlin Wall in 1989, I'll use the word collapse, the collapse of the USSR, the disintegration of the USSR. I sent a postal mail to Peter Lawrence and said, you know, hey, now you can travel more easily than you could previously. Why don't you come as my guest to the 1991 Winter Simulation Conference, which took place in Phoenix, and enclosed my card. I get email response back. They already have now email, as West Germany is pulling East Germany up by the bootstraps, as you can imagine, to the dismay in economic terms of some West Germans, by the way. Peter said, I can't make it myself, but I would love to send a couple of co-workers if that is okay with you. And so he did that. He sent two of his co-workers, Fulton Arhens and Henry Herper. And they started by being invited to the general chairman's private reception for the conference. And as soon as they walked through that door, I knew they were the two from Magdeburg, just based on physical appearance. Peter countered them by saying, why don't you come to a conference in Magdeburg in March of 1992? That was the first in a series of conferences in March in Magdeburg on the visualization and presentation of simulation models. And so I did that. I gave a paper on the use of animation in simulation, which was coming on very strong at the time, emphasizing proof animation that was a product of Wolverine software, using production materials for the lecture based in English, but actually giving the presentation in German, which I had picked up through assiduous study during the Fulbright year.
So you and him continue today to be personal friends and professional colleagues.
Oh, yes, that simply began. Peter has come to quite a few winter simulation conferences. He's been on the program quite a few times. I've been over there. We really have a very deeply rooted professional and personal relationship, including our wives and socializing together and that sort of thing.
Well, please tell us something about your simulation research. I know that you had an Office of Naval Research grant regarding output analysis, so we know your love for teaching is already established, but how about your research?
Well, a U of M business school colleague of mine by the name of Andy Andrews, who now unfortunately is requiescat in pace, Andy and I undertook to do research together in the analysis of simulation output. Andy was a crackerjack statistician who brought a lot to the party from that side, and as far as the modeling and so on, I brought that to the party, you know, from my side. So in 1981, we had a publication in the Communications of the ACM that was titled Conceptual Framework for the Analysis of Simulation Output. We then proceeded to obtain a two-year grant from the Office of Naval Research to bring to bear ARMA methodology, autoregressive moving average methodology, to the analysis of simulation output in 1984, I think it is, we published the results of that research in a journal whose name is rather long. It's called the American Mathematical...
American Journal of Mathematical Management Sciences.
A Journal of American...
American Journal of Mathematical and Management Sciences.
Okay, thank you.
And later, Dudowitz was the editor.
Okay, yes, yes, right, yes. We then, you know, just as a little bit of follow-on, we had an article on the analysis of simulation output in a encyclopedia published by Pergamon Press. And then I illustrated the possibilities for analyzing output using spreadsheets, you know, writing information out from an executing model, and then using the results as data input to methodology implemented on spreadsheets. So, as you've said, my real interest, a deeper interest, is in practical applications of simulation, and also in education with respect to simulation. So, for example, in that regard, just to mention a couple of things here, and I'll put on my cheaters, and maybe I'll get the names right this time. A GPSSH model for a hypothetical flexible manufacturing system. That was published in 1985 in the Annals of Operations Research and was republished in a monograph named Flexible Manufacturing Systems, Current Issues and Models, in 1986. Another example, Scheduling with Sequencing Flexibility, co-authored with Ramrock and Madugu and Udayan Nan Kiolar in 1994 and published in Decision Sciences.
Good. So you've had some hardcore, say, research doing the ARMA, autoaggressive moving average, and you've given application domain type work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you also have done editorial work for journals. So I know you've been associated with a number of journals. And so could you comment on your editorial work, please?
Sure. I think editorial work is has multiple facets of interest. It helps you keep up with the state of the literature. You know, for one thing, pass judgment in a constructive sort of way on developments in the pushing forward of the state of knowledge, and provides a service to the profession. To mention a couple of activities in that regard, Associate Editor of Decision Sciences from 1974 to 1984, Associate Editor of Simulation from 1982 to 1994, and Associate Editor of the International Journal of Flexible Manufacturing Systems from 1986 to 2006.
Well, thank you. Seems to be even doing your fair share of handling the editorial material. I also note that you're a fellow of Decision Science Institute. Could you tell us about you being selected as a fellow and the service you performed with that institute, please?
Yes, it was in the fall of 1967 that quantitatively oriented business school faculty came together to form a conference focusing on quantitative applications in the areas of business. That meeting was held in New Orleans. I went to the meeting, participated by giving a tutorial on discrete event simulation. The tutorial seemed to be well received. I became a charter member of that organization. It was originally named the American Institute of Decision Sciences, the letters AIDS. When AIDS came to take another meaning, the institute was renamed Decision Sciences Institute, or DSI. And so, as already mentioned, I had done editorial service for the corresponding journal that came out of that that grew out of that organization. That's an annual conference series that continues to take place. It is really thriving for quantitatively oriented, multidisciplinary business school faculty people. I also served as a national vice president for the 1977 to 79 period. I think the designation of fellow came about as a result of contributions to the area of simulation that came about in 1979.
That's a very nice honor. Could you tell us about some of the people who affected your career or influence your career? I mean, you must look at some people and say, ah, thank goodness for those people that helped me out in my career.
Yeah, but for the grace of God, there go I. Yes, well, gladly. First of all, Alan Spivey, Walter Alan Spivey, now Requiescat in Pace. He, after all, was he had at least three major degrees of influence. One was that he brought about my decision to join the faculty at what was then called the Graduate School of Business at the University of Michigan. It's now called the Stephen M. Ross School of Business after a $100 million naming gift to the school from Stephen M. Ross. That was point one. Then point two, he was instrumental in making it possible for me to stage these business faculty summer programs in computing that mirrored the corresponding programs that had been given at Michigan for engineering faculty. And then number three, of course, he was the one who was heads up, antenna up, very sharp guy, suggesting, hey, Tom, how about introducing a course into the MBA curriculum on discrete event simulation? I see it as a coming methodology. So, I mean, those, you know, wow.
Well, it seems to me you went to Michigan Natural Science Foundation to do graduate work. You got introduced to computers there. And then you got to join the graduate school business. And then you had Alan Spivey suggest that you do discrete simulation. You know, those four events that had occurred, we may not have the Red Book, or even the Red Book, yes.
That's right, and I wouldn't be sitting here now. And then this fellow, Jim Henriksen, whose name came up earlier in this interview. Again, Jim was a student in the winter of 1968 offering of this newly created course in the MBA program. Sharp as a tack, every darn time his hand went up, I knew I was going to be presented with a very thoughtful and thought-provoking question. And then the fact that he was wearing another hat, as already mentioned, in the context of the U of M Academic Computing Center, led to a dual relationship, if you will, between us. We got to know each other, you know, pretty well as a student, in some sense, more professional capacity, his more professional capacity. Jim was drafted out of the MBA program in the late summer of 1968, you know, as a result of the Vietnamese War. He then spent 2 years sitting at a desk in the Washington area, serving in a couple of different capacities. When he was discharged after 2 years, he came back to Ann Arbor, decided not to re-enter the MBA program. He spent 4 years working full-time in the Academic Computing Center. Our interactions continued during that period. He is the one who eventually conceived of, implemented, and made commercially successful the implementation known as GPSSH. My sense is that the introduction of GPSSH extended the viability of GPSS as a, you know, discrete event modeling language substantially. It came to the point where, as already mentioned, I began using GPSSH in lieu of the IBM product, both in the credit courses and in the short courses, and then eventually the short courses taught under the auspices of his company. So we've had over the many a year period now a close relationship at the professional level and at the personal level. I think Jim, through his influence on the course along which GPSSH has moved over the years, and my interest in it has been a very influencing person. The third person is the fellow that is interviewing me right now, Bob Sargent. Bob Sargent and I came to know each other quite well in the context of trying to basically prevent the Winter Simulation Conference series from going belly up. There have been problems that I won't go into in terms of getting together the next conference. There were problems that came to light very late And Bob Sargent and I, and a third person, Harold Hyland, decided that we would do our best to stage a 1976 Winter Simulation Conference, even though we, based on preferred points in time when such organization would begin, were behind the eight ball. But we made it happen. Paul Roth contributed, the National Bureau of Standards provided us with space at no charge, they provided us with ranking privileges. You were associate program chairman, I was program chairman, Harold Hyland was general chairman as well as proceedings editor. And then over a course of time, you and I came to have a lot of contact at the professional level and also at the personal level. And your high energy, you're dedicated, you're very capable in the research sector, more than capable. You're an innovator. You have provided a lot of service-oriented work on behalf of the simulation community. The simulation community would not be the same without Bob Sargent. I am totally convinced of that.
Well, thank you, but this is an interview about Tom Shriver, not Bob Sargent.
Well, I'm simply pointing out the reasons why you're one of the people who has had a strong influence on me.
Well, you mentioned previously to this, thank you very much, that was very kind of you, but previously you mentioned two or three times about GPSSH. I think we were remiss if we don't show your book that you wrote on GPSH.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. So one of the influences I don't think that I mentioned that Jim Henderson had on me was that he motivated me to write a book entitled Not Simulation Using GPSS, but An Introduction to Simulation.
Why don't you hold it up so we can see it?
Using GPSSH.
Yeah. Introduction to Simulation Using GPSSH.
Using GPSSH, a 1991 publication of John Wiley and Sons. Right. Yep. Indeed.
Okay, I just want to make sure we got through your pile of books that you've written. Yes. Okay, so let's move on to something that everybody knows, and that's your love of teaching. Your love of teaching is well known to everybody. You taught for over 50 years today, 4 years at Eastern Michigan, 47 years at the University of Michigan. You're teaching full-time yet. What have you been teaching recently, and what are your teaching plans for the future?
Well, my favorite course currently is an elective course that I developed in Michigan's MBA program. It's a course on the building and use of decision support models using commercial third-party add-ins that are based on Excel. And so we deep dive in that course into three methodologies. One is risk analysis, using as a methodology Monte Carlo simulation on spreadsheets. We use an add-in from the Palisade Corporation named AtRisk for that purpose. A second is decision analysis using probability trees on Excel. The commercial add-in we use for that purpose, also coming from Palisade, is referred to as precision tree. And then we use the solver that ships with Excel, not produced, of course, by Microsoft, but produced by a third-party organization named Frontline Systems, to deep dive in the areas of linear and nonlinear simulation. One of the things that the underlying platform for that course is modeling. Model building, and what I find is that that provides a tremendous takeaway for the students in the course, because we formalize the process of building models, and in many cases the students say, gee, we've never had the concept of models and model building and model use presented to us in this way at any point in our education, which I find surprising, but nevertheless, and the students come away from that course saying, wow, I never dreamt you could do this kind of thing with Excel.
Now, before you go on a little further discussing, you know, your education and plans, teaching plans, tell us the size of your classes you have and the number of students you teach currently per year in your MBA program.
Oh boy.
They're impressive. I just want people to know what kind of workload you're facing and how much the students love your teaching course. So tell us the sizes and how many you're teaching each academic year currently.
Well, each academic year I am giving on the order of about 500 course grades. By an academic year, I mean the fall trimester. Michigan is on trimesters. The fall, between the fall trimester and the following winter trimester, making up an academic year, 500 to 600 course grades are being
That means 500 or 600 students you're teaching.
That's right, except in some cases.
These are MBA program, MBA students.
These courses are courses in the MBA program at the U of M, but of course they're open to other graduate students at the U of M. And so among the types, if you will, of students coming to take these courses are students from the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy Studies, from the School of Public Health, from the Applied Statistics program offered in the School of Literature, Science, and the Arts, School of Natural Resources, the University of Michigan, of course, is a very has a very rich set of graduate programs and with very sharp students. But part of the reason for not wanting to stop is you're dealing with such sharp students who are so driven, so motivated, so capable. And they're elective courses. Nobody's there who doesn't want to be there. It's nirvana. It's nirvana. You know, there's a saying, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life.
Well, I remember you telling me that you have a classroom of size 90, and you have the students filling those seats plus sitting in the aisle. So it's just very, very impressive that you can track this number of students year after year. So, you know, your love of the subject and the presenting of the subject has got to be just truly amazing. So where are you planning to go? You know, you're over 50 years of teaching, so, you know, you're going to teach how many more years, or what are you planning on doing in the future here?
Well, I have talked myself into entering a three-year glide path now to retirement. That will take the form of being full-time in the coming 2013-14 academic year. That'll be my last year as full-time. Then in each of the last 2 years, I will be half-time. In this coming year, I will be trailed by a new hire who is going to eventually take over the first course in the two-course elective sequence that I developed and teach. Then in the summer of 2016, assuming I'm still alive and kicking by then, I will be officially retired. That will mean that I will have been on the U of M Business School faculty for 50 years. And, well, should I say how old I will be then?
Well, that's your choice. I didn't ask that question. I was not going to ask that question, but you're welcome to express. I know, but you can tell us.
So if I make it that far, I will be 80 years old.
Well, you're in outstanding shape at your age, and I admire your energy level.
My wife would probably disagree with you about my shape.
Well, she may, but I'm pleased to know that she'll be extremely happy to know you've made this commitment now in a recorded form that you're going to retire. Okay, I know you received some teaching awards. Would you willing to comment on any of your teaching award or awards that you received?
Yes, there's an award specific to the Ross School of Business. It's called the Victor L. Bernard Faculty Award for Leadership and Teaching. I received that award really just a couple months ago, about a month ago. The motivation, I think, there, not on my part, but on the part of the school, is leveraging teaching courses in such a way that existing technology is leveraged, making it possible to get to a relatively large number of students more efficiently than could be the case without the proactive use of technology. So examples there would be my lectures are video recorded. The links are put out at a website so that students who miss a class can nevertheless take the class, if you will, be present in the class. That's a point. The second point is nothing touches paper in either direction. Everything is done through websites. Students don't have to physically hand in paper, and I don't have to physically return paper. Students can upload assignments from wherever they have internet access. And in many cases, these students are like cats on a hot tin roof. They're all over the place looking for summer internships, interviewing, and one thing and another. The third characteristic is the courses are characterized by highly detailed starting point lecture files that are made available to them at a website before the class meets. These are not static lecture files that never change continually. Improve them from offering to offering. The very first thing I do the next morning after teaching is take notes to myself about what went well, what didn't seem to go so well, and implement ideas that I have for improving examples and that sort of thing. So it's a labor of love.
It has to be. We all know you love. So you received this award this last year. What's the size of number of faculty members in the school, in school business?
Oh, there are about 135, 140 faculty members now.
And we know the quality of the faculty in Michigan is outstanding, and you're one of the outstanding of the outstanding, so congratulations on that nice award.
Thank you for those comments.
Yeah, and I know you. In some years you teach more MBA credit hours than any other faculty members.
I think that's true on an ongoing basis these days.
That's fantastic. Looking back at over the past 50 years of your professional work, what part of your work do you regard as having had the greatest impact?
Well, you know, I have to say, in terms of leverage, that seems to be a no-brainer. I would say it's the combination of the Red Book and the Red Book. That material has gotten to a much larger audience than is the case for anything else that I personally, you know, have done professionally.
No, I don't believe anybody argued with you on that. So. What surprises did you have regarding your professional work, both negative and positive?
Well, on the positive side, first of all, I can mention a couple of things. One is, what I've ever dreamt as a graduate student working in the engineering faculty summer programs at the University of Michigan, funded by National Science Foundation, what I have ever dreamt that within the course of just a few short years, I would be doing the same thing, based on that model, the same thing for some, for business school faculty. That was, in retrospect especially, at the time I didn't really give it much thought, but in retrospect I look back at it and think, oh wow. Number one. Number two, the tremendous leverage that resulted in the normal course of events from introducing a course in discrete event simulation in Michigan's MBA program. I mean, who would have ever thought back then when this activity was first taking place that much of anything would come of it, except that there would be local offerings of opportunities to study discrete event simulation. So there was a multiplier effect there that came as a wonderful surprise. And again, it's not something that you wake up suddenly one day and realize is there. It's something that evolves over time. So those are two great surprises. I could really say that the third surprise is, you know, being educated, ready to go in chemical engineering at the PhD level, which itself was a very exciting topic in which to engage and so on. And I remember the chair of our department at the time, Donald Laverne Katz, University
of Michigan. Dr. Katz, well known, yes.
Of Michigan, you know. He looked at me after those engineering faculty summer programs and said to me, "Tom Shriver, you can write your ticket. You can go any place you want in chemical engineering." And yet, I made that leap into the business school context with all of these positive developments. I mean, when you think of it, it was a gutsy move to make.
It was a gutsy move, but I think you would have been successful no matter what career you chose. If you went to the chemical engineering route, you would have probably been maybe president of some chemical company. Yes. Did you have any negative surprises?
Well, a bit of a negative surprise, or it, let me put it this way, an eventual disappointment, was when the offering of that credit course on discrete event simulation in the UM, Stephen Ross School of Business, came to an end, offered for the last time in 1995. Now, it came to an end because interest on the part of the MBA students in the course had fallen off to the point that it was no longer economical to offer the course. But there's an underlying reason for that. When I began at Michigan, we took into the MBA program students who were fresh off a bachelor's degree in a high percentage of cases. In many cases, they were very technically oriented students. They had majored in mathematics, for example, in engineering. They were very happy to continue pursuing things on the relatively demanding technical level. But in the meantime, we have morphed, as have the top MBA programs around the country, into what are called post-experience MBA programs, where we don't take students until they have a work experience under their belt. So the average age of students changed over the course of my experience there from 21, 22 years of age to 27, 28 years of age. And the students coming back to continue their education at the MBA level come back not to that context for the purpose of sharpening their technical skills at the operational level, as much as sharpening their skills in other facets of the conduct of business. Many students told me, I'd love to take your course in discrete event simulation, but I just can't afford to use 3 credits on that course because I got all these other courses that have higher priority for me personally in terms of where I see my career going.
So, seeing that they don't want to go to the technical area, do you believe business school students should have some literacy in simulation? And if so, what?
Oh boy, I believe it very strongly, and I don't think it's just because it's an area in which I work. The way I think of it is as follows. Anyone holding the MBA degree should be, to the extent possible, an intelligent consumer of the professional's product. So, for instance, when it comes to using Monte Carlo methods to build models of situations that involve uncertain future outcomes that can't be predicted exactly, but whose range of alternative outcomes can be quantified within reason, and to come to an understanding of the types of insights that can be gained through such modeling, risk analysis, the pros and cons of going with a proposed project, for example, a proposed multi-year project that involves a lot of uncertain future outcomes. These MBA graduates really have to be understand what's going on in that area. They have to understand what kind of intelligent interpretations to put on modeling results that are being produced by people who work more full-time in that area than an MBA graduate typically would.
Very good. So they need quantitative ability, including simulation. Yes.
Yeah, but they do need quantitative ability.
Okay. I know you received awards for your professional work. Do you care to comment on any of the awards you received over the years for your professional work?
Well, the reward that I most value is the INFORMS Simulation Society's award, Lifetime Professional Achievement Award. I don't know when it isn't during the course of a person's professional career that the thought that, hey, you know, I'm in this career, I'm committed to it, I'm going to continue in it, I'm halfway through it, or I'm two-thirds of the way through it, and so on. When that might come into focus in a person's thought process, if ever, I just don't know. But to have a third-party recognition, if you will, of the type of the Lifetime Professional Achievement Award, I'm going to say, drop into your lap, that's not quite the way to put it, is a tremendous privilege and experience, and a tremendous, just makes you feel good all over to think that, that maybe, gol darn it, you accomplished something with all kinds of work.
Very, very nice. So where do you see the field of simulation going in the future?
Well, I'm very bullish about the field of simulation. I think that advances in combination of hardware and software, and advances in state-of-the-art in areas such as gathering and analysis of input data, in other words, model verification and validation, one of your strong areas, for example, design of experiment, analysis of output, education of both simulation producers and simulation consumers, the current vitality and strength of the continuing Winter Simulation Conference series. I'm very bullish about future prospects for simulation.
Fantastic. So what advice would you give a student today wanting to enter the simulation field?
Well, I think I would point out that simulation is, the way I think of simulation is that simulation is an umbrella. It's an umbrella that covers many sub areas. Some of them just mentioned, like verification, validation, model building, model use, design of experiment, analysis of output, you know, meaningful interpretation of results, ability to sell results to the person who controls the purse strings. I think the student who's interested in the possibility of pursuing simulation very seriously should be as careful as possible to take to achieve operational literacy in as many of those sub-areas as possible. It shouldn't be a narrow focus on one of those aspects. It should be a broad-based focus. And then, of course, such a student as a post-student in the professional life should probably continue developing himself, herself in those areas through short courses, for example, and self-study and what have you.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention in this history video of your professional life?
Well, the one thing I'm going to mention is to people who might have had the patience to sit through this video interview here until the end, is that there is a plan to have transcripts of these video interviews available in the simulation archives at North Carolina State University. And in some cases, they may be literal, that is, verbatim transcripts of what was said, but in other cases, they may show above and beyond the verbatim sequences of words that have come out in the interview. They may show a bit more spit and polish, if you will. They might extend some of the ideas that were presented. They might be sort of smoothed out in terms of pro sequences and that sort of thing. And I think people should be aware that there is that adjunct that's planned for these video interviews. And then the last thing I would like to say is thank you, Bob. Thank you very much for all of the work that you have put into this National Science Foundation funded sequence of video tutorials focusing on people who've been active in simulation for as many years as many of us have. I mean, this is another example of one of your significant contributions to the simulation community, and I thank you for that.
Well, thanks you for doing this interview with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.